seconds. 4, 3, 2, 1. Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Authority Smashing Hour with your hosts, Luke Jim and Mr. 1001 Nights. Join us as we embark on a journey through radical news and politics, take callers, and get you ready to engage in the struggle against capitalism.
Hello, everyone, and welcome once again to the Authority Smashing Hour, which is now on every weeknight. Starting this week, we started this new schedule, trying to have a show every weeknight, and we're going to have different hosts. I'm going to be on every night, but there's going to be a different co-host every night. And today we have a new host. His name is Eric. Hello, Eric. How you doing, man?
Good. How are y'all doing?
Pretty good.
Good to talk to you, John.
So maybe you'd like to introduce yourself a little bit and tell us what got you interested in these topics and, some of the things you've been going through lately.
Be glad to. It's a privilege to be on this show. Thank you for inviting me. And I haven't been an activist my whole life, actually. I'm probably the only person who knows Chomsky by his linguistic work. That's how I was introduced to him, because I was studying linguistics at one time before I got interested in politics. Like a lot of Americans, some decades went by, just working real hard and trying to support a family and all of this, and reading the newspaper and thinking that I knew what was going on. And I really didn't start paying attention until a little later in my life, you know, and with the help of some activists, Chong Chi being one, our friend, I started reading Chomsky and started to get an idea of the magnitude of the problem and the lies that really I had taken for truth this whole time. You know, I remember the Cold War, and I always saw things in those days as sort of the way we were supposed to see them, the good guys against the bad guys.
Right.
What I missed was that we could be bad guys too, you know, in a very simplistic, you know, a little model that was presented to us back in those days, that wasn't seen as really a possibility. And so I'm doing some catching up now. I've been active and I've been trying to catch up. I learned a lot from you guys. I watched your videos had the good fortune to make it up there last year to listen to Chomsky's speech at the Arlington Street Church there in downtown Boston, which is it was right after the election. That's what it was.
So what was that impressed you most about that speech? Were you impressed by anything he said, or were you, you know, did you learn anything new?
By a lot of things. Well, yeah, I did. And actually, since it was so well covered, there were many topics, but I want to focus in on one thing that he said that was very close to my heart, because he talked about two countries, Haiti, and he talked about Bolivia. And why was this close to my heart? Because I had spent some time in both of those countries and had seen the first day I arrived in Bolivia back in the 80s, the city was, La Paz had erupted into a riot. The teachers were rioting against the police, and there was great violence. The teachers were making $17 a month, and they were striking for higher wages. Tear gas was flying everywhere. This was an hour after I got off my plane there. And really, I was just going down there to, hey, let's go wander around South America, you know, 20-something years old, just looking for an adventure with my long hair and stuff. And but I got to see the brutality of it up front and took a lot of pictures and stuff. But I guess I wasn't asking the right questions at that time. What was really underlying this? You know, I had... You know, to me, it was a big adventure at that time. I have to confess, that was that was something I hadn't learned to do, was to ask the right questions. What Chomsky had talked about is that there had been elections recently in Haiti and in Bolivia, the two poorest nations in the Western Hemisphere, and how much better their democracy had run, and how the people had actually had the courage to rise up and put their own leaders, the leaders that they wanted, into office. And it's a lot more dangerous in Bolivia, and especially in Haiti, to voice your opinion and to go out in the street, because they don't just tear gas you, they will shoot you. In Haiti, I saw a lot of people, not hundreds of people, but some people get killed in the coup of 1987.
Yeah, a lot of our callers may not be familiar that there was indeed a coup in Haiti that overthrew the democratically elected president, Aristide, and then he was allowed to come in only by following some of the rules, the neoliberal rules of the Washington Consensus. So, yeah, there's an interesting story behind that. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, he angered the IMF. He said he refused to sell off the country's infrastructure to privatization, and so therefore he was ousted by the usual suspects.
You know, in our last show we were talking, we mentioned a book called Disciplined Minds, which is a great book that was written a few years ago, and it's about the how subservient some sectors of the professional workforce are to the government, to the corporate structure. And it was written by a physicist, mm-hmm. and he was talking about how, you know, even though in all these journals they like to describe themselves as being very independent, you know, scientists, they apply the scientific method, they're very, in some respects, they're extremely subordinate. So you were talking earlier about, you know, I mean, right now we're all sort of unemployed, and we're having, you know, the economy is not doing very well, but how you experienced in your own profession, even though you actually have a degree and a pretty professional in engineering, right? In computer programming or something.
Yes.
Right.
I've been working in computer software for a long time.
That you realize how hard it was, right, to find a job that would not be serving some of these a crude interest that you know all of us criticize.
It's almost impossible to find something that's perfectly clean. You know, clearly, as a software engineer, I get calls from people here in Washington D.C. You get calls from Lockheed Martin. You get calls from Northrop Grumman. You get calls from Raytheon. These things these emails come into my mailbox every day, but you know, I don't answer them. In fact, we even arranged a protest against one of these war profiteer job fairs last year when I was unemployed, and that felt pretty good. I actually got harassed by the CEO of the company that puts on that particular job fair. But I'd say a good 75-80% of the jobs here in Washington, D.C. are somehow linked with the entire military-industrial, financial, domestic repression complex. I have to add a few more hyphenated words there.
Let me quote something here from the book, and let me know, since you're a little bit older than most of us in this program, if your experience actually coincides with what the author Jeff Schmidt has to say about about these organizations. He points out that professionals are trusted to run organizations in the interest of their employers. And because employers cannot be on hand to manage every decision, professionals are trained to ensure that each and every detail of their work favors the right interests or skewers the disfavored ones, in the absence of overt control. And then he says, the resulting professional is an obedient thinker, an intellectual property whom employers can trust to experiment, theorize, innovate, and create safely within the confines of an assigned ideology. Do you feel that's the kind of environment that you find out there?
Very much so. Very much so. In the corporate world in general. Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, God. Okay. It has a way of weeding people out, you know. Now, we try to be, we're very good about not, you know, between co-workers in general, not to discuss a lot of politics at work, but still, if you have something on your background, like, for example, company I was working for was going to get a contract with one of the big war profiteers here for not anything that had to do with the warfare, but it was providing a service. Now, they might be able to, since they have a background on each one of us, be able to say, well, look, we're not going to give you this contract unless you get rid of that guy who's been working against us all of this time. Mm-hmm. You don't know. You end up getting a little bit paranoid. You have these scenarios. How much do they know about you? Do they question your loyalty, or is there some simmering resentment against it? And this is assuming that you're lucky enough to find a job that you can accept.
It's interesting because I had sort of the same experience this year. I only worked like 3 months in this whole year. I mean, it's been amazing because I'm a dance teacher, but the second I started working, I started thinking about, well, should I pull this thing out of Facebook? Should I do this? Should I do that? Should I try to make the profile mm-hmm. private? You start getting paranoid because you think, well, do I want these people to know what my political opinions are? And it's sort of like the whole environment encourages you to be as subservient as possible toward their, you know, the status quo.
It really does. You know, I found myself making my Facebook private when I got the last job that I had because I didn't want people looking at it. You know, I keep a LinkedIn profile as well, but that's completely, you know, that doesn't make a mention of my politics. So here we have to put on this face that's completely false just to fit in, you know, just to in order to look. I don't desire a fancy car or a house or anything like this, but just to get food and rent money, you have to go out there and be somebody that you're not. And if you can't pull that off, the mechanism will weed you out. Like Chomsky pointed out one time, I remember he was having some kind of argument with a newscaster, and he said, you know, the newscaster's point was he believed in everything he said. But Chomsky had pointed out to him, I'm paraphrasing obviously, of course you believe what you're saying. Because anybody who was a bit was more forceful and more or took a more unpopular, let's say, opinion would be automatically weeded out of that whole of the system, starting from school, you know, starting from they try to weed you out in school, they weed you out in college, they might send you to Harvard so you can become which is basically a finishing school, you know, for the rulers of the world. The whole system weeds you out. So yes, you see these people at the top and you see that, yeah, well, they do believe in what they're doing, because anybody who doesn't believe in what they're doing has already been weeded out long ago.
You know, it's interesting because I never talk very much about religion. I usually talk about, you know, the media and so on. But today I was watching a YouTube video by a guy called, I think his name is Joel Osteen or something. Some big preacher down in the South, maybe Texas or something. And mm-hmm. And he was talking, and he was saying, basically, you know, don't criticize the boss, don't criticize your employer. Try to see that. I mean, sort of like of course. I mean, you were talking about South America, and in South America, we have seen some of that more radical versions of religion, so-called liberation theology. But most of religion, or a lot of religion, has this effect that it just makes people more subservient. But, you know, at the same time, Michael Moore is exploiting some of the more radical tendencies of religion, like, you know, and that's, I don't know if you've seen his new film, Capitalism, a Love Story, but when people ask him, are you a socialist? He knows what the word socialist means to most Americans because of all the propaganda that they've been fed. So he always says, no, I'm a Christian, because, you know, Christians, you know, supposed to help your brother, and you're not supposed to lust after money, et cetera, et cetera. So, I think there's a lot of mechanisms that ensure obedience to authority, and you know, I guess, I mean, I think the media is probably, and the educational system are very important, but we're a pretty religious country, so I just noticed that this, and that we hardly talk about it. Are you religious in any way, or not?
No, not at all. I'm not. I mean, I am not on a crusade to wipe out religion, but I think Bertrand Russell put down his criteria for becoming a religious. He said, yes, if Jesus comes into this room and walks over here, shakes my hand and says, it's me, if he, something along those lines, if I can see some proof for it, but there's no evidence for that I can see of any sort of deity. But on, you know, on the other hand, if we want to get into a philosophical side of it, you know, I can do that. But I don't know if it's necessary. If we can't take on every single issue. And religion, though, is I think, who was it who said it? It's the opiate of the masses, and it is. It encourages irrational thought, but
Right, but at the same time, it has this radicalizing potential. Like, for example, the, you know, liberation ideology. Theology in El Salvador. You know, in the 80s, that was a big thing with Oscar Romero, and you know, and Michael Morris is trying to encourage some of that. So, I mean, I usually don't criticize it because I see. Because I think there's other things that are perhaps more important, but, you know, I do recognize the...
Exactly,
But, so anyway, but you were talking about Honduras earlier, and you've been actually following that, and so maybe you can talk about what's been going on there.
Well, I have been following it, and unlike our mainstream media here, which it seems to have fallen off the radar there. But if I'm going to listen to news, I don't own a television set. I can tell you I'm several decades old, and I've never owned a television set in my life. So that was at least one thing. But I don't see any Honduras coverage on the TV set. But I was, I've been following the Honduras issue. I had the great opportunity to meet briefly with the Honduran ambassador here in D.C. last week. And listened to an impassioned plea from Dr. Luther Castillo, who was up here from Honduras. He's leader of the National Front Against the Coup and the Garinfo movement. he's a medical doctor in a small village. He said it's bad. They're really cracking down on people down there. But we know all that stuff. What's the larger picture look like? The United States has a forward base there. It's the old imperial story. If you ever see these things, start thinking immediately, what's the imperial face of this? And it's not hard to put the pieces together. There's that base in Honduras, the same base that was the forward base for the terror wars against Nicaragua, against El Salvador in the 80s. Let's get that thing open. Because look, something's happened. A real disaster has happened to the people here in Washington while they've been distracted in the Middle East. Democracy's been breaking out all over Latin America. It's terrible. Look, all the countries.
That's what Chomsky was saying. That he was saying that, in fact, that they would have never allowed something like this back in the 60s, that it's sort of gotten out of control. So they're trying to reestablish some of that hegemony in that part of the world. But so many countries now are leaning leftward, and it's hard for them to you know, keep it under control. They still have Colombia. I mean, Colombia is sort of their main bastion, and they are trying to build more bases and so on as a sort of a pivot of of trying to undermine that whole region once again, but hopefully they won't succeed.
Yeah, hopefully they won't, but it looks like that seems to be the intention. I mean, all the symptoms are there. You can some of the United States organs like USAID is down there, and another organization is the IRI, I think is what it's called, is another thing. It's like the National Endowment for Democracy that was a CIA front that helped overthrow Chavez for a couple of days back in 2002. So they have, make no mistake about it, they want their South America back, you know, and they are allied with the half a dozen or dozen families that actually own the country there.
Mm-hmm, right.
And that's the same. It's true in every part. I lived in South America for several years, and the income disparity is horrific. In Brazil, where I lived, I think it was at that time, it was the highest income disparity in the world. I'll have to check that. But
did you ever see, in Brazil, when you lived there, because in some of these cities, I have, in fact, I don't know if you've seen my documentary, Golden Rule, but at the end, I show some of the images, some images from a film called Baraka, with some children, and apparently Brazil has these parts of certain cities which are inhabited by these children, tiny children who actually have to take care of each other because, you know, they're orphans or there's nobody.
Yes.
And sometimes apparently they get murdered. They have, you know, because they're...
Yes,
Yeah.
Yes, very much so. Those children get abandoned, you know, or they go off. Maybe it's a sort of a tribal instinct, and Rio de Janeiro's had a very bad trouble with just summary executions of these kids. They call them trombodinhos, is the word in Portuguese for these kids, and they end up. It's really sad to see them. I lived in a city in the Amazon, but it had started there too. Kids out on the streets sniffing glue, and they will rob you, and they will do crimes. But you have to; your heart goes out to them, and you think, what great failure has happened here? What breakdown in society where the children are having to sleep out on the sidewalk and steal things? It's sad to see.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of interesting that, you know, when people see that, they, you know, like the typical answer is, well, there should be more charity, or people would have to attribute that to sort of people really wanting these children to be out there. So, well, obviously, if nobody's helping them, but that's because they've internalized the capitalist market structure so much that they can't even think outside that framework. So they think, well, the only way that they can be helped, it's like, obviously, we got to live in a system that, you know, that doesn't make food available unless you can pay for it. We got to live in a system where, healthcare and those things cannot be guaranteed. That's like a law of nature. And so I encounter that all the time. Like, you know, Michael Moore was on Sean Hannity's show, and Sean Hannity was, you know, I mean, the answer they always give is that, well, you know, if people want, they can always give charity, but charity in a system of that's geared toward greed and that kind of stuff is just not sufficient and not desirable in the end. In the end, we want to have a self-managed system where we can actually take care of these needs in a manner that is humane and dignified. Because people who live off charity,
very agree.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That question of dignity is such an important one, you know, and the breakdown of the extended family and of the clan, the tribe, these things that humans lived in for hundreds of thousands of years, the way things are arranged now, it's very alienating. I mean, that's a key concept, I think, is the alienation of people and this go at your own and the nuclear family. These are all relatively new concepts in the long long history of mankind. It's very unhealthy. And
yeah, well, it's sort of rooted in who we are. I mean, for most of, I did a video a few days ago about how much of our economic life when we were hunter gatherers for most of human history was based on gift economies, and I mean we have those tendencies and they're simply repressed under our current system. So, but anyway, I guess we can take a break and then we can continue with the news. So let's play a song here. Let's see what song do we have here. 5 Million Ways to Kill a CEO. All right, let's go for it.
Slap him up and shake him up and then you know. Let him off the floor and pay him with the dough. You can do it drunk or you can just go. Yeah, just go. 5 million ways to get a CEO. Slap him up and shake him up and then you know. Let him off the floor and pay him with the dough. You can do it drunk or you can just go. Yeah, just go. What you waiting? On the turf debating how to get it percolating. You working, you well, we happy just to work a day. But I'ma slap him till my blood starts circulating. Do you test that elasticity? Did they cut off your electricity? Did you scream and yell explicitly? What's the boss into complicity? I'm a white truck sister, but I'm such a pisser. Rolling dope in rentals to your residential. Talk as fuck, eating lentils with no utensils. Finna teach pimp class with a whole credential. Take on sweatshops, fat cops, and filter cola. Murder babies with their molars on the areola. Control the Pope Dalai Lama, holy rollers, and the Ayatollah. Bump this rolling in your bunker to your new Pagola. You might catch me on the scenic route with my penis out. Yelling squads for the executives with the meanest mouth. Wanna know what this demeanor's about? Did they try to clean us out? Greenest flower, shut them down. I ain't calling you back. For the record, I ain't called it a gag. But touch this in the small of your back. When the bathroom starts to attack. 5 million ways to get a CEO. Slap him up and shake him up and then you know. Let him off the floor and bait him with the dough. You can do it drunk or do it this dough. You got it, yeah. 5 million ways to get a CEO. Slap him up and shake him up and then you know. Let him off the floor and bait him with the dough. You can do it drunk or do it this dough. You got it, yeah. Slow is the creeper. If you a janitor, get a street sweeper. Ugly is even too deeper. If you can't get the bread, get the beaver. They made the policy before there was a corner. I might have been born here, but I'm a foreigner. Stealing slaves for victims of pigs and I'm Phoenix kid. Flip off the lid, who you got? You supposed to be a crook, a dream killer, bean filler. Gangster love just like Steve Miller. They wear city vests made of chinchilla. Factory in Mexico, but I'm Spring Miller. I'm from the land where the Panthers grew. You know the city and the avenue. If you the boss, we'll be smabbing through and we'll be grabbing you. Just say what's up with the revenue. And if you get it, we can even try to steal it. Just 5 million ways to get a CEO. Slap him up and shake him up and then you know. Let him off the floor and bait him with the dough. You can do it drunk or do it just go. Yeah, it's up. 5 million ways to get a CEO. Slap him up and shake him up and then you know. Let him off the floor and bait him with the dough. You can do it drunk or do it just go. Yeah, it's up. Boom and chop prostitution when they show up at the stroke. Their restitution. You could throw a 20 in the batter hot oil when he jump in after his watch him boil. Toss a dollar in the river and when he jump in, if you find he can swim with lead boots on him and do it again. You and a friend, videotaping a party don't win. Tell him that boogers be turning like crack. He gon' put the little baggies in his nose and suffocate like that. Put a 50 in the barrel of a gun when they try to suck it out.
Alright, well that was enough of that. Pretty long song. You still there, Eric?
Yes, Mr. 1001.
All right.
I hear you.
Well, I guess we could talk a little bit about Israel, Palestine. I'm reading here some of the slaughter continues. Palestinians says seven Gazans hurt by IDF fire and border. And apparently they were able to deflect some of the criticism that came to them via the United Nations. You know, it's interesting because there was a report by the United Nations, which was Directed and managed by someone who's very supportive of Israel, and
Goldstone, yeah,
right. And nevertheless, he, you know, in fact, at first they asked him, you know, you got to do a report about Israel, and he said, well, I won't do it unless I can look at the crimes of both sides. So, I mean, this guy was not against Israel. He was trying to be as you know, he's not against Israel, but anyway, the evidence was so overwhelming that he came out with the report, and you know, and now he's, you know, being criticized for being anti-Israel, and apparently this report is Israel's celebrated over the weekend its success at the United Nations in forcing the Palestinians to defer demands that the International Criminal Court investigate allegations of war crimes. So, I mean, that stuff just continues. It's just amazing. I mean, it's been going on for so many years. I remember when I became an activist back in 2003, 2004, right after the Iraq war started, that I started, you know, hearing about the Israel-Palestine thing. And, man, it's like every week, every month you hear of more killings, more oppression. It's incredible. And I'm sure you've been around longer, so you've probably seen it for even more years.
Well, I tell you, that issue was one that woke me up more than anything. I think that's when I really, you know, for years I would read the Washington Post and read the newspapers and think that I knew just as much as I was supposed to learn. You know, I was going home to the wife, I was paying my car payments and doing this and working real hard and reading the newspaper, thought I understood the issues. But it was in, I guess it was in the last year of the Clinton administration when they had the last attempt of the Camp David Accords, which was clearly it was Ehud Barak and it was Yasser Arafat, and they were giving, it was a raw deal for the Palestinians, but all of the newspapers were saying that it was the Palestinians' fault. That's when it was really when I decided, you know, this newspaper is lying to me. You know, I used to believe what it would say to me, but
right.
It has an agenda.
I think in that particular deal, it was that all the newspapers were talking about how generous the deal was, but when you actually looked at it, they said they never showed any maps, because the second you looked at a map, you realized that it was not a good deal. That in fact, that the only ones making concessions were the Palestinians. That by the standards of international law, they were making far more concessions than they could have if they actually struggled for their full rights under international law. So yeah,
exactly.
There's
a very powerful propaganda engine up here to convince us otherwise.
Yeah, the Zionists are very good at that. And I mean, just in this last report, I mean, like there was there's certain things they say that sound pretty convincing. Oh, you know, the language, you could just read it right away. It was so biased, and you know, the United Nations, you know, we know they have a history of this, and they have all these things they say. And it seemed it was like that. And then I heard Finkelstein on Democracy Now! Talking about how the guy that directed this study was actually pretty pro-Israel. And he said he actually teaches at Jerusalem University. So then you realize, holy moly, this stuff is the opposite of the truth. It's not that it's anti-Israel. It's actually pro-Israel. You know, it's pretty shocking.
He's Goldstone was the judge on that, and he's Jewish, and he's very pro-Israel, and that's one reason they chose him, because it was the only way they could conceivably get the Israelis to pay attention to it. But they still dismissed it out of hand, the Goldstone report. It was a disgrace. It's really a disgrace, but they're losing popularity, but, you know, I don't think they even care anymore, because they own our Congress, they own our president, they have infiltrated every, you know, everything they possibly could. They don't really need popular opinion anymore. They're not trying to win any popularity contests. With Netanyahu in there, it's just is a disaster. He is a, you know, if he could get away with it, he would... Yeah, he's a terrible man.
Wipe him out, no doubt. So anyway, so to change subject here, I know you've been following some of the healthcare debate, and apparently it's just boiling down to nothing. I mean, there's just not going to be a solid public option. The things that are being offered are just ways for the insurance companies to still control the whole system.
Yeah, it's really one of those cases where they give you a false choices, basically. They say, well, here's the radical socialist Democrat program, and here's the, you know, whatever the Republicans have, a Soylent Green option for the Republicans. What they've taken off the table, from what I understand, and I haven't followed it that closely because all I see is both the Democrats and the Republicans serving their corporate masters. But even the public option plan is a great way to pay large sums of money to the insurance companies. Like I said, I haven't followed it that closely, but there's so many of the Democrats have been won over by the insurance industry. You really, now you get to see the full force of the lobbies working every day down there on Capitol Hill. And yeah.
I think when I was finishing my documentary, I remember that I added one thing at the last minute, and it was on August, I think, the 17th. That it was the first headline coming out saying that the public option had been defeated, and so basically they say insurance companies have already won, and then the next day on Democracy Now there was a report saying the same thing. So the thing is that popular support is so great. You know, but the people really want more government involvement in healthcare. And some sections of the capitalist class also want healthcare, public healthcare, because the costs of healthcare are going up so much that they themselves are being hurt. So it's I think those are the main reasons why it's being debated. But we know which section of industry has more power right now. It's the financial sector, and a lot of employers are just, they're afraid of being taxed more. I think that's their ultimate fear. They're afraid of paying higher taxes, and you know, that's, and of course, you know, the fear that it will lead to more things, you know, more social democratic measures.
Yeah, it's true. There was a time in this country where I think the top corporate rate was much higher than it is now. I don't know what the top corporate rate is now, but it may have been well over 50%. But so. That's okay. Some of the rhetoric that you hear down on Capitol Hill is, oh, you're going to turn us into Sweden, you know, with these high taxes and this socialism.
Right.
And,
but it, you know, the question
is... I called my Swedish friend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead.
Go on. I'm sorry, I interrupted again. But, well, they started talking about Sweden, so I called up my friend in Sweden and asked her how she liked her system. She said, yeah, it's great. You know, we pay high taxes. Yeah, but we have a lot less stress. We don't worry what's going to happen to us if we get ill, you know, no matter what your station in life. We don't have the stress of wondering if you can afford school, you know. We don't have we don't fear homelessness and all that, you know, because even though we pay these high taxes, we still have a better quality of life, and all studies point to the socialist countries in Europe as being the happiest ones.
I think the question also that is never raised, since we deny the existence of class, is on who's going to be taxed. Okay, so if you said, well, yeah, we're going to tax the rich more, you know, if that were proposed, I don't think a lot of people would be against it. But when they say we're going to be taxed more, the assumption is we're all a big happy family. There are no classes, and obviously, you know, these social democratic measures tend to adopt more progressive taxation, and that's what's not really being mentioned. In fact, a lot of these corporations don't pay much taxes at all, and And that would be, see, that is a small step toward taking some more control over the economic system, being able to democratize the state, to implement some sort of progressive taxation. That would be a first step toward a more democratic society. And, you know, hopefully they'll be able to get something, but I'm so afraid that this thing is just not going to go through. So anyway, so we have other items that we could discuss. Afghanistan, of course, that's still going on, and people getting killed all the time. Mm-hmm. And apparently, now that the conflict is more is the region is called AFPAC, because in fact, originally both Afghanistan and Pakistan were not separated. It was sort of it was a British imposition, from what I hear. So, but yeah, I just read this news item that says that Pakistan is insulted by new bill by the United States. So they're basically providing all this aid, military aid and stuff, but with certain conditions. And they're saying, well, these conditions are going to undermine our sovereignty. But of course, Pakistan is already a client state of the United States. And but I think
it is.
They're going to be stuck in Pakistan for a long time. I mean, there's just no way that they're going to give up. And you know, like the Russians encounter the same problem. You know, when they try to, and of course back then the Russians were fighting against guerrillas that were being sponsored by the CIA. But but you know, right now I really don't know if some of the guerrillas in Afghanistan are being sponsored by foreign powers, but my guess is that not nearly as much as the Mujahideen were being sponsored during the fight against the Russians. That's my guess. I haven't read anything.
That's my guess too.
Yeah, I don't think there's any indications.
Well, one thing that became one indication that became clear in the 80s when the Russians invaded Afghanistan. And they overran the country and were clamping down pretty hard. We ran Stinger missiles over to our CIA ran Stinger missiles over to them. So it was pretty obvious to the Russians that when their planes started getting shot down, that they were getting help from the United States. It was another proxy war, like Vietnam, like Central America, like so many places around the world during the Cold War and in that context of the Cold War. But I haven't heard of any special high-tech weapons or any, you know, innovations that would imply a great amount of aid from a foreign power there in Afghanistan. Afghanistan has a population of, 25 million people. You know, they will never submit. You know, they'll fight to the last person. And this will be a very expensive... I mean, aside from it being a war crime, they're looking at a permanent occupation of that region, right, of the entire region, a permanent occupation of Iraq, a permanent occupation of Afghanistan.
You know, I think that one of the mistakes, which is, of course, not a mistake, it's part of the propaganda about the war, is that, you know, after the smoke cleared about Iraq and, they didn't have weapons of mass destruction, blah, 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 it became that, the Iraq war was a quote-unquote mistake, but the Afghanistan war was a good war. And
right.
I suggest to anyone who hasn't heard a different version, I suggest that they read Chomsky's account of that war in the book Hegemony or Survival, because there he goes step by step explaining what really happened. And what really happened was that after 9/11, George Bush told the Afghani people, we'll keep bombing you until you turn over to us people who we suspect were responsible for 9/11, even though we refuse to provide you with any evidence. Now, Chomsky pointed out that, the Taliban were, you can call them the worst thing since Genghis Khan, but that they were not unreasonable, there was no reason to not believe that they didn't want to get bombed and destroyed. So therefore, and their request for evidence was not unreasonable, and so, you know, if someone were to tell the United States, look, We're going to keep bombing you until you turn over to us people who we suspect committed a terrorist act against us. The United States wouldn't stand for that. The United States wouldn't stand for, even if the evidence was actually crystal clear, they wouldn't stand for that. So the thing is that we have such low standards for other nations and such high standards for ourselves that you know, everyone thinks that the Afghanistan war was not a war crime. But in fact, by the standards of international law, it was a war crime. That it was not justified. International law says that you can only engage another country militarily if you are under the threat of immediate attack, when there's no time for deliberation.
Exactly.
And no choice of means. Afghanistan was not going to military attack the United States. There were maybe. In fact, what Chomsky points out is that the head of the FBI, Robert Mueller, I think his name was, he pointed out that, in fact, they didn't know for sure. You know, about 6-8 months later, he testified and he said they didn't know. So it's not a good war. And there's been so many war crimes and so many atrocities that is, you know, it's really time to demand a full withdrawal from not only Iraq, of course, but Afghanistan, Pakistan, and all these other countries. So
exactly. Yeah, look at who wins in these wars. Who really are the winners? The oil companies. Now, Afghanistan doesn't have any oil, but its geopolitical position is very important. It's one reason the Russians invaded. They wanted a warm water port to carry that Caspian Sea oil out of there. And Hamid Karzai, who's the puppet leader of Afghanistan right now, he was an employee or a consultant to UNICAL out there in California.
With
the express the reason was to figure out how to lay a pipeline across Afghanistan. And that has a lot to do with it. But war has this other side to it, is that it's a very important instrument in the class war, in that it moves wealth upwards, because we, the workers, pay the taxes, and the big corporations that make the tanks and bombs and napalm and drones pocket the money. That's
right.
A big part. That's one reason they want to have a war anywhere.
Right. In fact, I think like some of these bigger wars, it was like they would say, well, you know, now is not the time to form a union or picket or do it, because we got to be united. We united against this big enemy, external enemy. So let's not fight among ourselves. Don't think about fighting against your employer, getting better wages or anything like that. Just do as you're told and
go shopping.
Right. Well, yeah, that too. That was kind of funny.
Bush told us to go shopping on September 12th.
Yeah. Yeah, that was really interesting. But anyway, so earlier you were actually talking about there was a government whistleblower, and you were talking about that. Did you what were you talking about there?
Well, Sibel Edmund. There was let me see if I can compact this story. Sibel Edmund is was an FBI translator. She speaks Azeri, Farsi, Turkish. I had the opportunity to meet her at the American Library Association, where she spoke in 2006. But she was, as she was translating all of these documents and all of these tapes, she realized that there was this huge crime ring going on that was dealing in arms and in blackmail of politicians over here, and it had a lot to do with the trafficking of state secrets, I'll say classified information, and selling it out on the open market. It involved the Turkish government, and it involved the Israelis, and she names names, and some of these names are in Congress. Dennis Hastert was one name that she named. This has been going on for some time. When she understood through her process of translation that there were these huge crimes going on, and this treasonous crimes, she alerted her superiors to it, and she was fired. And everything. And she was, a gag order was put on her under the State Secrets Act, and she's been fighting it ever since. Her life had turned into this Kafkaesque nightmare, where even her birthday was classified. She was in her speech. So, like, what is she supposed to do? But give the police her driver's license, her birth certificate, her birthday on it. But anyway, she has come forth and has been naming names. I'm not sure the exact status of the gag order, but this is the crimes that were committed back in 2001 are very serious. And I encourage anyone to go to her website, which is justacitizen.org, or you might find, I'll just Google her up and pick up whatever you can find on there. It's a fascinating case, and she's a very brave whistleblower. And here in Washington, the life of a whistleblower is dangerous, you know. And there's been some legislation on the Hill about it lately, and you just don't blow whistles. This is part of that, and this fits back into our conformance thing. They try to bully you. They try to, and that's what they did with her. They made her life miserable. Because she was going to uncover these crimes. So it's an interesting case to follow. And she's an extremely courageous woman.
So do you remember of any other cases of whistleblowers, like important cases in the past 2 years? Which one?
Colleen Rowley is one. In the smoke clearing from 2001, several people stepped forward and said, look, we had all the information that we needed to say that this was going to happen. Colleen Lilly was one whistleblower who came forth, and I'm not as familiar with her story, if she was punished for her testimony. Richard Tice, I think his first name was Richard, was from the NSA, and he had a similar situation where he had seen wrongdoing in the. And had tried to come forth and suffered severe consequences for it.
I'm reading really,
the government.
Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the government's, it's kind of an organized crime ring, you know, and you don't break the code of omerta.
Yeah. Well, in fact, I was just reading here more fodder for the racket here. It says Senate okays $626 billion for war military spending. I don't even know if that includes the wars, but so the Senate has passed a $626 billion military and war funding bill by a 93-7 vote. So only 7 people voted against this, and you know, I wonder what the reservations were. The measure also includes a provision barring the transfer of Guantanamo Bay prisoners to the United States. Man, that's a huge, huge amount, and that's a lot of money. Yeah, and they also talk about their shift to some certain amount of capital to develop some Iran-focused bombs, bombs that are especially designed to blast some of these underground bunkers and stuff like that. So
the bunker booster bombs, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, they've tried several times already to stir it up with Iran. They tried that whole green revolution thing had a great deal of American involvement in that.
Yeah, what I was going to say, they've been saber rattling for a long time, but nothing has happened yet. But it's just, it always looked like it's on the brink, but it doesn't happen. You know, they're about to attack. But it's just like so many wars already. They're already in so many countries that if they started bombing Iran, I mean, the consequences could be ominous.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. You know, yeah, I wish I had a key note to that.
You know, and another thing that I don't think we're hearing much about is the depleted uranium. Because for a while it was on the news, but you know all the depleted uranium that's been used, and the consequences of that. I haven't seen any studies. You know, the last study I saw was maybe a few years ago, and there was a movie made about it right after the beginning of the Iraq War, it looked terrible. It looked as one of the most ecological disasters in history. But apparently, I mean, I'm sure it didn't go away because that stuff is around for billions of years, but they're just not talking about it.
It sure does.
And, you know, just to talk about the bigger picture here, I read an article on New Scientist magazine, which, of course, most of those scientist magazines have a pretty pro-capitalist point of view, but they do have some articles that are sometimes pretty good. And this one was talking about, just sort of like casually talking about, well, yeah, we're probably going to self-destruct. I mean, that's what they were saying. They were talking about climate change and how... And how some of the scenarios were like that our global warming was sort of a reaction that would be just absolutely, you know, terrifying, and the oceans would start boiling, and that was the worst scenario. But then the better scenarios, those were still pretty damn bad. I mean, it's just like that should be the priority. The fact that we're destroying the planet and ourselves, and instead we're worrying about these little, you know, little things here and there. It's just, it makes you want to, you know.
It's very true. Yeah. It kind of goes back to the bad decisions that we make. Kind of go back to we're still the same people that lived in those caves 200,000 years ago, and we make decisions that affect our immediate life and our immediate surroundings rather than looking at very long-term problems and things that affect other people. And there have been some studies on that kind of thinking. So,
yeah. I mean, the environmental catastrophe deserves a lot of attention, and you know, if all those billions were employed in trying to solve that problem, you know, that could make a difference. But it's just I don't know what kind of world I'm gonna see when I'm your age, you know, maybe, or you know, when I'm an old man, you know, 60, 70, 80, it's gonna be pretty scary if I'm still around, of course, and there's no guarantee. But
This is one reason that people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, it's one reason people, I think, don't become activists, because this isn't fun. You know, confronting these truths is not going to make you a happy camper. But what else do? You know, because once you know the truth, you can't walk away from it, and you have to look at yourself in the mirror every day, and you can't respect yourself unless you face the truth. You know, once you know it, it's a bitch, but.
That's right. You gotta face reality. Well, I guess with those words, we'll end the show here with a song. Thanks for visiting the show, Eric. I really appreciate
really good talking to
you being here, man. All right, so we're gonna end with a song, Union Song by Tom Morello. Enjoy the show.
Here we go. For the $5 workers who are twisted, tricked, and robbed. For the peasant in Guatemala in a sweatshop got your job. And she can't feed a family for the pennies that she makes. Meanwhile, the crime rate's rising up and down the Great Lakes. The vegetables left in the field, the signatures smell rotten. On the contract and the deed that pushed the race down to the bottom. They load the rubber bullets. They fire another round. I'm headed into the tear gas. Dig in, man. Hold your ground. Put your hips in your ass. Fought in their own time. For our brothers and our sisters up and down that picket line. For the unnamed and unnumbered who struggle brave and long. For my union men and women standing up and standing strong. Yep. That's right. No queremos juntos, vamos a ganar. See, y'all hit them where it hurts.
and hit the hand that feeds. You might get one of three, or probation and fine. Well, I know where I'm gonna be. I'm gonna be right on that front line. For killing the South who fought in their own time. For our brothers and our sisters up and down that line. For the unnamed and unnumbered who struggle brave and long. For our Union men and women, stand up and stand strong. Dirty scabs will cross the line while others stand aside and look. But ain't nobody never got nothing that didn't raise their voice and push. Like the steel worker in Ohio, the miner in West Virginia, the teacher in Chicago, janitor in Mississippi. From the sweatshops of L.A. to the fields of Mission Flats, there's a thundercloud exploding, and I'm free at last. Like Joe Hill and Cesar Chavez, who fought in their own time. Like our brothers and our sisters up and down that picket line. Like the unnamed and unnumbered who struggle brave and long. Like the Union men and women standing up and standing strong. Like the unnamed and unnumbered.